Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins on the local news roundup. A judge rules he won't certify Mark Harris the winner, so we must wait for the state's elections board to decide what to do in the 9th District voter fraud case. Mecklenburg County sends out the first property revaluations in 8 years. Stand by for sticker shock. The government shutdown shuts down the annual State of the Union speech, and South Carolina's Lindsey Graham responds in a tweet storm. No big dig for cats, but they do have big plans, and they're still looking for the big money to carry out those plans. And doctors are on the move again in Charlotte. Our roundtable of reporters is ready to detail those stories and others, and those reporters include Alex Olgan from WFAE News. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Glenn Brookins joins us from QCityMetro.com, where he's editor and publisher. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Dick Ochsner is here from WBTV News. Hi.
Top of the day to you.
Thank you very much. And Ann Doss Helms returns. She is education reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Good morning.
Good morning.
We're all on the radio. You can also watch us on Facebook Live this morning. So we start with an update on the 9th Congressional District, where no winner has yet been certified. Republican candidate Mark Harris's campaign petitioned the courts to step in to force the state to declare a winner, but the court wasn't so inclined. Wake County Superior Court Judge Paul Ridgway said any action by the courts would be inappropriate.
This is an extremely unusual situation with no board in place, and asking this court to step in and exert extraordinary power to declare the victor in an election that is clearly a purview of other branches of government.
The board he is referring to is the State Election Board, the old body which refused to certify Mark Harris the winner, despite his 905-vote lead over Dan McCready, was dissolved. When will the new one come into being?
The 31st. What is that, next Thursday,
I believe? Do we know who the members of that board are?
We will find out today. We now know the pool. We have the information on the pool of candidates. The new board will take effect January 31st. That is because legislation passed by the General Assembly late in December said this wouldn't take effect till January 31st. That's before we all knew that the old board was going to be dissolved by a three-judge panel. And so this week, the Democrats and the Republicans have both put forth lists of four people to be nominated, candidates from each party to be nominated. There will be three Democrats because that's the party of the governor. There will be two Republicans on the board. And already that has caused some angst and controversy.
Who makes the decision?
The governor. So the parties say, here are four people. Governor, you get to pick. And so what we know now, the Democratic Party came out yesterday and said that two of the people are disqualified by law from sitting on the new board.
Why?
Both because they had engaged in electioneering within the last 2 years.
And electioneering is what? Campaigning for someone?
Essentially. Okay. Yeah. And so by law, then they would be disqualified from being on the board under the new law that was passed in December. Mm-hmm. So they've said, look, what a sorry slate you put forward. The Democrats put out their list yesterday. The names are three of the names are of individuals who have previously been on the state board. The fourth name is someone who's been long involved in elections.
So what was the makeup in terms of political party of the old board?
Sure. And the political makeup gets to the heart of the reason why a three-judge panel declared it unconstitutional and dissolved it. It was four Democrats, four Republicans, and one unaffiliated.
Is that why the Mark Harris campaign wanted to have a judge make this decision before the new board came into being, which would be balanced toward Democrats versus Republicans?
No. The Mark Harris campaign filed this motion or this action to have it certified because they just want it certified, period. and they filed this way back in early January. In court timeline, I think you could say this was pretty quick, but in, you know, real human life, which is 10 times faster than court life, it took a while. They filed this action because there was no board, because Also, so Judge Ridgway, senior resident, Superior Court judge in Wake County, very good, very well respected, but, you know, never underestimate a North Carolina Superior Court judge's ability to get out of having to make a decision he doesn't want to make. And that's what we heard, I think, from Judge Ridgway there. But there is some precedent, I think, because we didn't have a board for pretty much all of 2017. And in 2017, Judge Ridgway, and then in some instances, the Court of Appeals, also had to step in and perform some functions of the State Board of Elections. And so the Harris campaign's argument was, look, there's not a board right now. We don't know who else to turn to, so we're going to go to the courts because it's seemingly the next best thing. Judge Ridgway said, hey, I think you guys can wait.
I know we've talked about this in the past. I want a little update here on this situation because before the holidays or during the holidays, the Republican Party really was calling for a completely new election, including new primaries. And everybody was on board from the top, I mean the very top down. Why the change of heart?
Well, you know, you're talking about the week before Christmas, right, is when this plays out. So literally one day, Dallas Woodhouse says, there were some irregularities that may have been beneficial for the Republicans and harmful for the Democrats. There were some irregularities with the election that we found. So because of this, there must be a new election. The end of that week, I sat down with Mark Harris for the first time and said, boy, what do you think about your party calling for a new election? And his quote was, I don't feel the Republicans circling the wagons around Harris like the Democrats are around McCready. And you know what? That next week, the Republicans said, we don't need a new election.
Wow. All right. So Judge Ridgway, who made this decision to wait for the new board to come into place before certifying a winner, is a Democrat. Does anybody believe that the decision would have been different had the judge been Republican?
I don't believe so. And again, I think Judge Ridgway is among the most fair and contemplative and deliberative judges in the state.
Glenn.
That kind of goes to another point. Everyone is really looking at this incoming board, and rightly so, because this board will be responsible for certifying the election. But I'm much more interested in what the staff investigators are doing. But hopefully that is really going to decide what happens.
And that investigation has been ongoing, absence of a board.
Right.
So it seems to me that this is a white-hot issue, that transparency will have to be paramount. Will we know, will we see all the machinations going on in front of us?
Yes. So the board has already said soon after we have the staff at the board has already said soon after we have an actual new board, we are going to have an evidentiary hearing. That hearing originally was supposed to be done by December 27th. Then it was scheduled for January 11th and couldn't be held because there wasn't a board. Now, this week, I reported that mid-February, sometime between the 11th and the 18th-ish, that subject to change from the new chairman, whoever that may be when they get into office, and that will be a public evidentiary hearing. Now, here's what I'm not sure that will come out at that evidentiary hearing, and that is what evidence did the board have in their closed session at the time they decided to not certify the election? I believe that information should be made public. The board has still refused to make it public.
And we were talking about who will be on the new elections board, but one of the biggest developments in that is we know somebody who will not be on the new board, and that is Josh Malcolm, who was the one that most of us here in Charlotte discovered existed, right, when he spoke up and said, we're not certifying this, we've got problems.
Well, and good scoop by your colleague Jim Morrill at the Charlotte Observer, who talked to Josh Malcolm. Revelation that Malcolm will not serve on the board, he'd served on a previous iteration of the board. He had been vice chairman when he made the motion to not certify the 9th District. He then became chairman when his predecessor resigned. But this new development that him not going back on the board comes after it was revealed that he had a long and frequent back and forth communication with a Democrat member of the Bladen County Board of Elections in the days leading up to the November 2018 election. That board member is now part of the ongoing investigation.
Alex.
So all of these affidavits and things that are coming out over the course of this investigation, that'll obviously be in the evidentiary hearing, but are there other things that are in process that we're not seeing on that portal?
Most of what's on the portal is stuff that is not part of what the investigation entails, quite frankly. And I, you know, because if they're making a the state board, while they have said, look, we want to be as transparent as we can, and they've released some things that are public record anyways, arguably, they've been very clear that they believe, and I kind of disagree, but they believe that they are subject to a portion of the state law that protects records of criminal investigations. And so they detailed in a letter to Congress last week that all of their evidence stays in locked rooms. And I found out this week investigators were gloves when they go in to handle these things. And so we know that investigators are still on the ground in Bladen and Robeson County. We know they're still talking with people. And don't forget, at the same time, investigators with the State Bureau of Investigation are also on the ground. And Wake County District Attorney Lauren Freeman, who also has a criminal investigation into this subject matter, has said that she anticipates her investigation to be done in the next 1 to 2 months.
So State GOP Chairman Robin Hayes has already said that this ruling by the courts does nothing to change the fact that Mark Harris won the election, and he said that he has confidence that the new Board of Elections, which comes in as next week, January 31st, will certify that outcome. Is he being premature?
Well, he's saying what you'd expect the Republican to say when your candidate won, right?
Why say anything?
Because they want us to be able to publish another story today about the 9th District. But I think, look, and this is kind of the same tack that David Friedman, the kind of lead attorney for Mark Harris's campaign, said after the hearing. He said, look, this doesn't change anything. We're going to go forward in the process, and we ultimately think the process will show that we won this election fair and square.
This is kind of like the Mueller investigation, but on a much smaller scale. Everyone wants to kind of get ahead of the investigation and predict the outcome.
Right.
We're going to have to wait and see what they have found. How widespread were these allegations of voter fraud? And hopefully that will decide whether that election is certified, not by how many Republicans are on the board versus Democrats.
And will the House of Representatives accept it if the board certifies it? Because they could do their own investigation into this.
I think if the board certifies it, they will be under increased pressure to
accept.
And the House is concerned because they had previously said certification doesn't mean we're going to seat him, which
right.
would be a very crazy and dangerous precedent. But I think their concern was if he's certified without a full and public investigation and presentation of evidence, which is the only way the board would vote to certify Harris. And so if it gets to that, then I think they would accept the result.
So there are other things going on with the governments that surround us. The federal government has now been shut down for a month, and that has led House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to shut down the State of the Union message, which was supposed to be delivered next Tuesday night. It could be, but doubtful, because even if they opened the government, I'm not sure they could get their act together by then. But that annual speech, since the early 20th century, has been delivered before the Congress by the president in the House with a joint session. Not mandated to be that way. It's just a letter to Congress near the first of the year. We'll talk about that a little bit later on. But while the government shut down, there'll be no speech in the House. And that has led South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham to say that this decision set a new low for American politics. It is certainly a departure from tradition. Is it a new low?
Well, there's no surprise that he's on Twitter saying this. His audience is one, the president of the United States, who has loved Twitter. And I think that's exactly who he was targeting with this statement.
The State of the Union has been delayed. This is probably the first time it's been delayed because of partisan bickering. Because of partisan bickering.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's not unprecedented.
Lindsey Graham tweeted that this is a, quote, tradition which has been carried out during times of war and peace, turmoil and tranquility. He didn't mention government shutdown. Nancy Pelosi's initial retraction of her invitation to the president, she said that it was due to security concerns during a shutdown. And then she said it would be wrong to deliver a speech during a shutdown. Is this just political theater? Is that all there is to this?
Yes. I mean, and Donald Trump also canceled her trip overseas
right.
to a war zone because you couldn't do that somehow during the shutdown. And Lindsey Graham did acknowledge that he also felt like that was not the right thing to do. And he said, one sophomoric response does not deserve another. So that's where we are in our discourse.
Okay. Well, we're going to come back and talk a little bit more about that and the increasing reaction among local people to how they're being impacted by the shutdown. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on the Local News Roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We are here with Ann Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer, Alex Olgan from WFAE News, Nick Oxner from WBTV News, and Glenn Birkins, editor-publisher of QCityMetro.com. So the government shutdown is underway. It has delayed, possibly, the State of the Union, which until 1913 was delivered in letter form by the President to the Congress. That's what's in the Constitution, that the President must report on the State of the Union once a year at the beginning of the year. It was Woodrow Wilson who began making these speeches in Congress because he realized it was a marketing opportunity to tell his side of the story to the public. And then when radio came in, it really took off. But the Constitution says the President must make this State of the Union message to the Congress near the first of the year. The President seems willing, although it's doubtful that it will happen, to let this thing go, this shutdown, go through February into March, possibly April. So if he doesn't give a speech until April, is he in violation of the Constitution?
Well,
April's not the beginning of the year.
He surely could. I wonder, could he consider a tweet? The State of the Union.
It's great.
Trust me.
Yeah.
I mean, there's nothing in the Constitution that spells out how the President delivers it. As Mike pointed out, it was in writing. Now it's and I'm sure something is still delivered in writing, but now we think of the State of the Union as a broadcast.
Is it? Do you think it's even necessary? I know it's in the Constitution, but do you think it's necessary, because don't the people in the House and the Senate know the State of the Union already? And given communications that we have today versus in 1776 or 1798, and hasn't it become just a showboating opportunity for the man in the Oval Office?
And this is a man who does political theater in a whole different way, you know, a reality TV show host. I think it's going to be fascinating. He loves campaign rallies. Could we have a State of the Union that looks more like a campaign rally?
You could, but I think he realized himself, and he said it.
It's surprising when even Donald Trump says that would be too much, right?
Yeah.
Look, I don't particularly have a lot of heartburn over there not being a State of the Union, and this was long before Donald Trump was president. I mean, I don't know that what do we gain other than networks having a reason to, you know, pump up and promote some more coverage?
In the past, State of the Unions have been used not just to say the State of the Union is fine, but presidents have also used it to put forth proposals.
Policies,
new spending initiatives. And there was a time when those types of things actually made the headlines out of a president's State of the Union.
And all kinds of traditions have been broken with this presidency, so it doesn't surprise me that this is another.
But I have to say, Nancy Pelosi, that was a brilliant move. Say what you want about it being petty or political theater, it was a brilliant move. She took something away from him that he really wanted. And I never believed for a minute that he was going to take it anywhere else. It would have made him appear weak and even like a president in exile.
Although, of course, he did have an offer to come here to North Carolina from our House Speaker,
who
offered, what was it, the majestic character of our State House Chamber and splendor of North Carolina's breathtaking landscapes.
So, has he seen our State House Chamber?
You just have to wonder, are they writing this stuff with a straight face? Because it also said North Carolina, like Washington, D.C., has a balanced government that provides opportunity for all voices to be heard.
Whoa.
They can't be laughing at themselves, but are they serious about this?
One wonders. So the shutdown continues. It's beginning to have a tangible impact on federal workers whose paychecks have stopped. They'll miss the second paycheck today. Some of those workers have also been ordered to work without pay, among them TSA employees.
What do we want?
End the shutdown.
When do we want it?
Now.
What do we want?
End the shutdown.
That's the sound of TSA workers picketing at Raleigh-Durham Airport on Wednesday, calling for an end to the shutdown. One of those picketing workers, Tangela Campbell, says she loves her job but feels disrespected.
The issue is not continuing to come do my job. The issue is trying to live after I finish my shift.
So we're seeing stories of federal workers in food lines, others looking for financial assistance because they can't pay their rent, they can't buy gas, they can't buy food, and since many are living paycheck to paycheck, they are worried and they are frustrated. How many people in this region would fall into that category? Do we know? Have we been hearing any anecdotal reports? Have we been sending people out to find these folks?
Do you know? I don't know exact numbers.
No.
I don't.
No, not. But I think when this started, we heard, 800,000 people, and we kind of thought, it's mostly a D.C. thing. But I think the longer this has gone on, we've realized
but
it.
But this is also a trickle-down thing. It's not just the 800,000 people. It's the lunch counters that they rely on. It's the Uber drivers and transit people that get them to work. It is the gas stations where they buy. Some of these people working for free are now saying that they can't work for free because they can't get to work because they can't buy gas.
But that's – so that's, you know, the bigger point
here. Are they exaggerating
here.
That?
No, I don't believe
so.
No,
I don't think TSA gets paid that much.
No, and if you're not getting paid anything, how are you supposed to – you know, I saw a TSA worker in Hawaii who was living in his vehicle at the airport because he couldn't afford to get back and forth, and he had to be at work.
Right.
But so my point here is I think we all thought, it's not that huge of a deal. It's mostly a D.C. thing. But now we've seen a month in, it really has a – it is a big
deal. So Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross yesterday said that he didn't understand why unpaid federal workers were using food banks. He suggested they should take out loans – to stay afloat. And, of course, many of those employees might be unable to get those loans, I would imagine. He said, quote, the obligations that they would undertake, say borrowing from a bank or credit union, are in effect federally guaranteed. So the 30 days of pay that people will be out, there's no reason why they shouldn't be able to get a loan against it. And we've seen a number of ads from financial institutions doing just that.
Weren't there salaries?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Weren't there salaries federally guaranteed?
Well, yeah.
Look, I also spoke to a federal worker earlier this week who has a top secret security clearance, and I said, "Oh, you're going to go take out a loan?" And they said, "Well, that might hurt my credit, and your credit is one of the biggest factors of getting a security clearance."
And I believe they can't get unemployment compensation either. During the recession, we had some unpaid furloughs, and we could get unemployment compensation because we were really not working during that week. They're saying, you know, you don't get any benefits because you're going to get paid. You're just getting paid.
Are there banks and other financial institutions offering loans to federal employees to tide them over in this? And if so, at what rate?
I don't know about the rates, but you've heard about, you know, loan offerings. It's a good question about the rates and what are the terms, right? How long do you have to pay it back?
You'd have to think they'd be more accessible from these payday lenders in places that have notoriously bad terms than, you know, walking into Wells Fargo and filling out an elaborate mortgage.
And a lot of these employees are not full-fledged federal employees. Many of them are contract workers who will not get this money when it's over. They won't get the back pay because they're contract employees, and many of them are living hand-to-mouth, and they're living in rental housing. And if they can't pay their rent, what are landlords who have mortgages? What are they supposed to do?
We just heard a story about that this morning on Marketplace, and this landlord was saying she has a number of Section 8 tenants, and she relies on the government to pick up the rest of the tab, and she's not getting her money. She may not be able to pay her mortgage.
And not to go too deep with it, but there's a time value of money as well. A dollar you give to me next year is not worth the same dollar that you give to me today. So, some of these people will never be made completely whole.
Well, if you have to take out a loan and you have to pay interest on the loan, that interest is not going to be made up in your paycheck. That's money lost. Is this a really painful illustration of the great divide between the haves and the have-nots? People who have no clue what the average person goes through.
I mean, I think Wilbur Ross is a good example. I don't know his entire monetary history, but he is very wealthy,
I
am sure he is a far cry from knowing what this is like.
There have been a number of insensitive statements. My favorite was a lawmaker who said this is the first time in American history that individuals have been required to work without pay.
Oh.
Oh, really?
Like, no, not really.
Not really, no. So both parties have come up with plans to end all this. None of them seem to have any traction. And yesterday, I think there were two votes in the Senate on competing bills, one sponsored by a Democrat or Democrats, one sponsored by Republicans. Both went down to defeat, although about six or seven Republicans crossed the aisle to vote for the Democratic bill, not the Republican bill.
Which you had some who voted for both.
Yeah, well, and so the six Republicans who supported the Democrat measure is now being cast and used kind of as a sign to from Senate Republicans to go to the White House and say, look, our ranks are starting to crack here. And, you know, you started to hear negotiations between Chuck Schumer and Mitch McConnell, the Democrat and Republican Senate leaders, to start trying to see if they could find at least a short-term fix.
Evidently, Charles Schumer, Senator Schumer, and Senator Mitch McConnell got together late last night to start to try to work out a compromise, and the president said that he would support a reasonable agreement. Did he define what that means?
There's been a lot of talk about a down payment on the wall, and everybody has agreed they're willing to spend some money on border security, so it becomes, do we define this in a way that feels like a win?
Isn't that a non-starter? Nancy Pelosi's also backed herself into a corner. She said, there will be no money for a wall. We don't need the wall. There will be no wall. So if he's saying a down payment for the wall, she's already said to reporters, I don't know that he knows what that means.
And he's changed the goalpost of what a wall is anyways. At first it was concrete, and then it was steel slats, and like who knows what he's going to say a wall is next.
Okay, there's other news, including CATS. CATS here, of course, is the Charlotte Area Transit System. They've been working on expansion of light and commuter rail for a long time, and Wednesday of this week they released some details of their 2030 plan, and they're proposing two new light rail lines. Where?
To the airport is one. Mm-hmm. I'm personally hopeful about that one. I think it'd be very convenient.
So this would go from the airport to Matthews? This is the east-west line?
Well, I think eventually it's going to go into Gaston County, into Belmont, which I'm excited about.
But even so, it would go to Matthews, right?
I think it would, through downtown.
Yeah, okay. Basically down 74 through downtown and then down Wilkinson to the airport,
okay.
Yes.
Okay, and then they want to expand the blue line, I believe, through Pineville into Ballantyne, which is something they should have done from the very beginning, it seems to me. But they want to do that, and they're now talking about a bus line, not commuter rail, to Huntersville, Cornelius, Davidson, etc., because the Norfolk Southern is not going to give them right away on their track, period, not going to happen. So we've talked about buses along that corridor for years, and there seems to be resistance to that. What's different now?
Well, that there is literally no other option, and I think that's the most significant from this proposal.
Couldn't they have built it down the middle of I-77 when they were doing all this construction?
Maybe.
A lot more expensive than a bus.
Yeah, maybe not. I don't know. You know, I think there was, I mean, the red line, which would have been that north corridor, has been something that's been in discussion for a long, long time. And I don't think anyone would argue with the need for more commuter options, right up to North Mecklenburg County. But there's just no way to build it. That's what CATS is now even coming around to. Literally, we can't get it done. The interesting thing to me, though, is that the toll lanes on I-77, down which this new express bus would theoretically run, was built with a lesser thick pavement than your typical highway, and because it's not intended to be used by many heavy vehicles. So the quality of the road is just not capable of handling as much heavy traffic. And so if we have a commuting option that's going to involve heavy buses carrying people up and down the toll lanes, it raises questions.
We'll be repaving it next year.
I mean, but this is a consequence of when I was reporting on this a couple years ago, they were also doing 85, and I'd drive up and down and I'd look at how thick the concrete is there, and you start to notice this.
You know, when you say CATS has realized they just can't build that rail line to Huntersville, I'm old enough to remember there was a time when we could do almost anything. Why can't we do anything anymore? Why can't we build that rail line? Why can't they find a way to do it? Why can't they condemn property and take it?
Well, they could. That is very expensive. There's not enough money. And they already don't know how they're going to pay for the Silver Line, which is the
East-West
Matthews to Airport or Belmont thing. I don't know that anyone knows how they're really going to extend the Blue Line to Ballantyne, but they've said this is what we think we're going to do. But money here is the biggest problem. We're talking about tens of billions of dollars worth of construction.
Where is that money going to come from? Because the transit, the half-cent sales tax for transit is tapped out.
And only generates less than half a billion a year. And so I really don't think they know. Most of the transportation, like the Blue Line extension that finished last year, that goes up to UNC Charlotte, was funded half roughly by the U.S. government, and then mostly the rest picked up by the state. Right. It makes you wonder. So we know that Mayor Vi Lyles has some chits to cash in with the General Assembly because she got the RNC here, and you know she's the most popular Republican in the state. That's what I joke these days. Obviously, Democrat. She has some chits to cash in. So it makes you wonder if this would be one of them that she would call, you know, when she goes to Raleigh and says, hey, why don't you help us out a little bit?
So I was looking forward to the tunnel, and apparently there isn't going to be a tunnel, because if I understood the quote the other day correctly, they said that they had no expertise on building tunnels, and it was going to be very expensive to do a tunnel, so they couldn't do it. Well, I can tell you that the Metropolitan Transit Authority in Washington, D.C. had absolutely no expertise in, they ran buses. They had no expertise in building a subway system. But you know what? They did it because they brought in people who knew how to do it. Why can't we do that?
I think money again. And I
this east-west line is going to skirt the city, right? It's going to skirt uptown. How are you going to transfer into uptown? How are you going to get on the blue line to get to the transit, to the center of town, if it's going up around 277 and down Wilkinson Boulevard?
Well, it would.
Will it be to anybody?
It would come back. I think there would be a stop at the Gateway Transit.
And where will that be?
Johnson and Wales.
Yes.
Roughly.
But that doesn't connect to the blue line. It doesn't connect to east
west. It would probably connect to the gold line, I believe.
That's the streetcar?
And that's going to change from the trolley-looking thing within a year.
Right. But your point is well taken. It would be great if you could go to a transit center, take the silver line, take the blue line, whatever.
Will the silver line connect with the blue line somewhere near NoDa? Will there be a transfer point?
There should be.
I think it would go somewhere north of the city, just north of uptown. I don't know about NoDa.
But we know the blue line runs up through there. So, I mean, it would have to cross the blue line at some point, just the longest route. But I applaud Katz for trying to come up with the most realistic, to the extent we're talking about tens of billions of dollars worth of things, come up with the most realistic and the in terms of budget that they can. I think that's what they're trying to do.
Well, I feel a future Charlotte Talks coming on with this topic.
You're getting the tingles?
I am. But this is part of the 2030 plan, which sounds really far in the future. But you know what? It's 11 years from now. Can they accomplish any of this in 11 years? Really? That's a long time, but it's not. And it's a lot of work, and it's a lot of money.
And it feels to me a representative of the problems that cities that were not built around public transit face when they try and add it later.
Okay. How much money might come from property tax? Because if you browse the Saturday sections in the newspaper, the real estate sections, or if you've surfed the web or just casually checked Zillow from time to time, you know that Charlotte housing has gone up in price, and we know that we're under the first revaluation in 8 years. The property tax notice or the revaluation notices are going out right now, and if you haven't gotten yours, you can go online and check, and I did, and I almost had to pick myself up off the floor. Given what I saw there in terms of what happened to me, because it's been 8 years since we've been revalued. Have any of you received your notices in the mail yet?
I think they went out yesterday, perhaps.
You can go look them up online, but I don't think they've actually hit the mailboxes yet.
And definitely, you know, what you're seeing on social media and what you're hearing is there's a lot of the reaction that you just described.
Whoa, baby. Whoa.
Even from county commissioners yesterday.
Yeah.
Well, we'll talk about, because the revals are not a tax bill, and they will not necessarily mean that your taxes are going to go up as much as your house value did. And we'll talk about that when we come back, along with Dr. Drama. It's not just on television anymore. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Alex Olgan from WFAE News, Nick Oxner from WBTV News, and Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer, and Glenn Birkins from QueenCityMetro.com. So the property valuations are going out. They say that residential property has increased as much as 54% from 2011. But we have somebody in our audience today who will take issue with that because theirs is much higher, 43% for residential, 77% for commercials, what they say. So Mecklenburg County Tax Assessor Ken Joyner says these assessments are market-based.
And it's even neighborhood to neighborhood because you could have properties that are near each other that some were appreciating at a higher level based on supply and demand factors and what buyers and sellers are agreeing to in the market.
So last time this was badly bungled and it resulted in a lot of resignations and a revaluation of property because people appealed to a great degree. Is that likely to happen here? Do they have to do this if you appeal? Do you appeal your valuation or do you appeal the tax bill which will come out in July that is based on this new valuation? Does anybody
I think
know?
You have to I appeal think, the evaluation right. as opposed to the tax bill. There's there's two steps to this. They do the revaluation, and then they have inevitably a much bigger revenue stream coming in. And then also inevitably they adjust the tax rate down. They don't just keep all the benefits. So depending on whether you fell above or below average, you might see a tax increase, a tax decrease, break even.
Right.
But George Dunlap, the county commissioners are off having their retreat, and they're talking about this. And often they shoot for a revenue neutral, you know, which still is just an average. You still might go up or down. But he's saying, look, we've been seeing this lobbying for more money for schools, for more money for parks, for pre-K. And we just saw an election where the Republicans who talk about holding taxes got voted out and Democrats got voted in. So he's talking like...
So if you do the same thing, you'll get voted out too.
I was about to say, he's right. Talking like a man who doesn't want to be.
Yeah, so here's exactly what he said.
We want pre-K. We want parks. That's what they told us. Now, the question is, are you going to deliver on that? Because if you expect that a revenue neutral budget will deliver those things, as Mama said, you got a wake up call. It ain't going to happen.
Sounds like he's in church. But he's saying essentially, we're going to see a property tax increase. He sounds like he doesn't anticipate, he's the chairman of the board, that this is going to be a revenue neutral situation. Is that what I'm hearing?
That was a pretty strong signal that he sent, I'd say.
Well, certainly sounds like that's what he's arguing for.
Right. If you're going to get these other things, right, they come with a price tag.
And we do have that $77 million shortfall on the Cross Charlotte Trail, but that's a city budget, and this is just county talking. All the municipalities, including Charlotte, around the county, also use this valuation to declare their property tax rates. Are we going to see them go through the same conversation? Are they aiming to be revenue neutral at all? Does anybody know? Has anybody
I think we'll see
it?
Seven different conversations about that.
You know, it's budget time, so I think that'll be a conversation worked into the budget. But here's, I'm following on Twitter this morning. I think many of our colleagues are at the retreat this morning, and my colleague David Hodges, who's there in Greensboro, is tweeting about there's a discussion happening right now as we're on the radio about there's a surplus. The funds, the coffers, the county's coffers look good, apparently, is the discussion going on right now. And it seems to me, and you did this program, I think, last month, where you had the newbies on the council on, and it seems...
On the commission.
The commission on. And it seems like there might be some of a tension between the newbies and the old hats over whether or not, you know, they seem to be pretty clear when they were on this program last month they wanted revenue.
We also did a program with the outgoing Republicans on county commission, which is now 100% Democrat. And they essentially warned Democrats, whatever you do, it's all yours.
I think Jim Puckett's been gleefully has made that very clear.
Yeah.
And that's fair enough.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it is. CMPD Chief Kerr Putney has announced plans to help CMPD officers deal with citizens who may have, mental health issues. What is the plan?
They're going to have what they call clinicians. I'm not 100% sure if it's therapists or exactly how they're licensed, but they're going to go on calls with officers and help unless there's immediate danger, you know, because they're not police officers. So police officers will step in if you know, need be.
So this will be six teams, as I understand, of mental health professionals on call 24/7.
Mm-hmm.
How many people on a team? How many people are we talking about? What's this going to cost?
I'm not 100% sure on how many people on a team, but I thought I saw the figure about $3.5 million.
Over 5 years, I believe.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, other cities have done similar things, and results have, I think, been good. But, you know, what about if that person's on the team that responds to this call? Then what are you going to do?
And why does Chief Putney feel this is necessary at this time?
He made a comment about how across the country, not just in Charlotte, there have been issues where people with mental health conditions have gotten shot or killed when responding to calls without this kind of training. Now, one thing I wonder is why not bring on board full-fledged officers who also have this background?
And aside from the police shooting situations, if you were to go to the county jail, you would find a large percentage of the people in lockup have some type of mental challenge. And so it's not just to defuse those situations where a suspect might be armed, even though my understanding is that they won't be. These clinicians would not be used in those situations. That's a law enforcement situation. But also going out with them on calls where the suspect is known to have a mental issue and trying to get that person into treatment, trying to be sure that person's taking his or her medication, mm-hmm. those types of things, not just diffusing hot spots.
Before we move on, I want to put out a correction, because I said that the State of the Union address has to be given by the president, constitutionally mandated to be given at the first near the first of every year. And a listener pointed out that that is not true, that the Constitution does not require a January State of the Union. So I pulled out my handy-dandy pocket constitution.
He's not lying, folks.
It's right
really
here.
Has.
Red,
it's
one white,
of the rare
and blue. Times Article- watching on Facebook Live actually adds to the drama.
Article 2, Section 3, he, being the president, shall from time to time give to the Congress information of the State of the Union and recommend to their consideration such measures as he shall deem necessary and expedient. He may, on extraordinary occasions, convene both houses or either of them, and in case of disagreement between them with respect to the time of adjournment, he may adjourn them to such time as he shall think proper. So from time to time, we can do the State of the Union in front of a joint session. So we don't have to do it that way. There it is.
And we don't have to do it in January.
That's right. Thanks to the listener for bringing that up. Thank you. All right. Dr. Drama, it's not just on The Resident or Grey's Anatomy. It's in full view in Charlotte. Last year, we all went through this months-long embarrassing drama where doctors wanted to exit from Atrium Health, about 90 doctors, I think. Mm-hmm. And it was in the newspapers. Both sides were taking out full-page ads.
Well, let's just back up because it's easy to get these conflated. There were two large doctors' groups about the same size that ended up leaving Atrium. One was about a contract dispute about anesthesiology, and that's separate. The other one, the 90-plus that originally sued, now it's in the 80s, that formed their own practice called Tri-Medical Partners. That was less of a legal drama because they basically just filed a suit, and then Atrium said, okay, fine. We won't challenge it. Let's just negotiate good terms. And then the back and forth was over how to notify patients, and because, you know, it's very confusing.
So it was a year ago. So it's a slow contagion, but it obviously has made its way to Novant.
Yep.
What's going on there?
So we know very little. We know that 41 doctors likely will be leaving Novant. We got an email from the practice that says that they'll be joining, which is a multi-state group called Holston Medical Group. But we don't know which doctors will be leaving. We don't know if they are primary care or specialties. I mean, there's been some speculation. I've reached out to some.
Do we know how many?
41.
Okay.
Is what Novant and what this other group has said.
Okay.
Now, 41 is sizable, but it's not nearly the 80-plus that left Atrium. The bigger the medical group you are, the more negotiating power you have when it comes to insurance.
Is this likely to be as ugly or embarrassing as the Atrium exits were last year, or has Novant learned from that?
You know, they're being really, really tight-lipped, so I don't know. And we haven't seen recently, I mean, within the past year, as many public court battles with Novant, so I'm not sure.
This bucks a trend because here and around the country, hospitals are gobbling up doctors' practices and doctors are coming willingly into the fold. This is the reverse. What's going on here?
And I talked to an analyst in D.C. about this exact thing last year, and I quoted some numbers that by 2016, about a third of doctors' practices were owned by hospitals. She was saying that trend's going to peak and it's starting to trend the other way, but she was saying that the situation in Charlotte was unusual because it was such a large group of doctors that were leaving a large hospital system. But, you know, one other thing she pointed out is doctors aren't necessarily used to having people or like having people dictate what they can do in terms of their care, and people may be realizing, well, it's just not worth it to deal with that.
So the headline story, I believe, Glenn, in your Queen City Metro this week was about Bennett College, which has to raise $5 million by February 1st, which is next week, or it will have to close after 145 years. This is an historically black college for women, one of only two remaining in the country. Is the cause of their money troubles the same as what a lot of historically black institutions are going through, the fact that there are more options for students now?
Absolutely. These schools, these historically black colleges and universities, they're remnants of slavery and segregation. This one was started 8 years after the Civil War ended. It was started to educate freedmen. I think in 1926, it became a women's college. And just as you said, as education options open up for African Americans, opened up in the past and continue to open up, as larger schools actively recruit the best black students coming out of high schools. HBCUs are kind of falling on hard times, and Bennett has fallen on harder times than many.
So given the other options that are out there now, how important is this in the community? What impact will this have, and how is it being viewed?
If you talk with advocates of HBCUs and graduates of HBCUs, and there are numerous of those, they would say that it's a huge deal. Despite the additional educational options, HBCUs continue to graduate a huge percentage of blacks who get college degrees. And in many cases, these are people who might not be able to get into larger institutions. So they fill a very important role in our education system, and Bennett, as well as Johnson C. Smith at one point, which was also on probation, they're falling on hard financial times.
Bennett lost its accreditation because of monetary problems, not academic
financial
problems.
Instability.
So they have till February 1st to raise $5 million. What are their chances of being able to do that?
Well, they're at about 2.7 now. They got $1 million yesterday, $500,000 from Papa John's pizza chain, which surprised many people given the given the history of all that. And another $500,000 from the Z. Smith Reynolds Foundation here in North Carolina. So yesterday was a $1 million day for them.
Wow. Well, we'll see what happens next week. Let's do a hopscotch very quickly through CMS and education there. For the first time ever, we have more than 20,000 immigrant students who need help with English within the system. That's 21,145 students, to be exact. What impact does that have on the schools and on the cost of providing educations?
Well, when you have students who do not speak English fluently, you need teachers to support them. They spent $30 million on that English as a second language department this year. That's up from about $20 million just 5 years ago. So there are more than 300 ESL teachers or English as a second language teachers, and that included the county ponied up a little over $1 million this year.
And a new, in 2013, voters approved money for a new school in South Charlotte. They just broke ground this week. What took them so long?
Well, they approved a list of bond projects, and this was the last one. And they're never speedy, and CMS likes to point out that the county actually controls how quickly to issue. It's essentially a bond issue is essentially a 7-year line of credit. They just got to their last item. If you live in those South Charlotte school districts where your schools are highly crowded, you probably are saying about time.
So the 2020 presidential election is underway. Every Democrat in the country is running for president, but two Democrats who have yet to declare were on the road in Columbia this week. Both spoke at an NAACP event for Martin Luther King Day where Bernie Sanders called the president a racist.
We have a president intentionally, purposely, is trying to divide us up by the color of our skin, by our gender, by the country we came from, by our religion.
At that same event, New Jersey Senator Cory Booker took a different tone but tried to stir the crowd up.
This is not a time for us to rest in our country. The work is not done. The dream still demands. The call of our country is still loud, and the question is, are we dissatisfied?
He's running. And Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren has already declared, and she's paid a visit on Wednesday to Columbia College to make her pitch.
These are really difficult times for us and a dangerous time for our country. And the direction we go in from here, in no small part, is going to be determined by people in South Carolina.
Is that true? We only have 30 seconds. How important is South Carolina going to be to the outcome of either the Democratic primaries or the election?
So important. All those people just went there in the last week or so.
And remember, Mark Sanford's seat was just flipped blue, and that's a big deal because that hasn't happened in a long time.
Well, more to come on that issue. And it's just beginning, and I guess we'll be a focal point of it. And, of course, the RNC will be here in 2020, so lots to talk about in the years to come about that. Alex Alden from WFAE News, Ann Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer, Glenn Burkins, QCityMetro.com, and Nick Oxner, WBTV News. He's on your side. Thank you all for the hour. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.